And good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon. Whatever the case may be around this rotating globe, welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. Remember how I told you years ago that things would get weirder and weirder and weirder? Well, as has been asked many, many times, in the last 4 years, have we reached the bottom yet? Well, I would like to rephrase that. Have we reached the break point in the script where things dramatically change? We're going to find out. We're going to try to look ahead into the future tonight based on good history teachings, I should say, and some very lively, and I'm going to tell you right now, warn you, very far out conversations. Because if you think the internet is full of theories and conspiracies and wild ideas, you ain't heard nothing yet. I haven't told you my theory. And anyway, that's just kind of a tease. Before we get into tonight's show, I want to do a couple things here. A couple very sad things happened today. Larry King, iconic TV and radio interviewer and host on CNN of Larry King Live for a quarter of a century, 25 years, died early this morning. Now, the other legend that I want to mention briefly is Hank Aaron. I watched Hank Aaron growing up, you know, watching his various baseball triumphs, starting living in Maryland, where racial segregation was very obvious. I've told the story a couple of times of what happened to my parents and our restaurants and bed and breakfasts and all that, because the town fathers didn't like that we served those people. Anyway, Hank Aaron was brilliant. He was congenial. He was incredibly talented, and he is in the history books forever. So Hank Aaron, rest in peace. Let's go back to Larry King. The Larry King story is really intriguing because I knew Larry, and I knew him off and on for many, many years. It started out, you know, decades ago when I was in California, and I was totally bored one night, and I actually turned on. I was staying with some friends, and they'd all gone to bed, and there was nothing on TV, so I turned on the radio. And on the Mutual Radio Network was this guy named Larry King. So I listened, and he was very interesting. He had really intriguing, really, really kind of cool people. And again, in a kind of a foreshadowing of, you know, where we are tonight, it was like he was doing a modern version, kind of one of my favorite old-time radio shows, Long John Neville. After which, of course, this show is very, very loosely patterned. So I called in. When he asked for calls, I called in because there was some guest, it was some science thing, and bizarrely enough, I was able to get through. By the way, there's a kind of a trick, or there was a trick back in those days to getting through, which I'm trying to remember what it was. Anyway, there was a way to get through, so I was able to get through, and I was persistent enough that he picked up the phone, and there I was, and so I started talking with Larry about the guest and with the guest. And at the end of that, Larry was apparently very impressed. He said, "We ought to have you back as some kind of a science advisor." So fast forward the film. Years later, when he was at CNN and broadcasting from Crystal City, which is that all-glass complex across the Potomac River from metropolitan Washington, D.C., I would go over many nights, and I would just sit in the studio when he did the program. And so, you know, we kind of got to know each other, and I would, you know, make a few comments when we were in commercials, things that might be useful to ask and that kind of thing. Anyway, fast forward the film much further, and many, many years ago, back in, I think it was 92, I finally got the invitation, because I got the Angstrom Medal, to be on Larry King Live on CNN. And my most memorable memory, can there be a memorable memory? Yeah, of course there can, was that the conversation was very difficult, because remember, I was selling the concept of Cydonia and NASA cover-ups and imagery which they weren't showing us and a whole other interpretation. I mean, come on, that's pretty hard to go down easily. And so it wasn't until I got to the paperwork, because I had a little stack of research notes in front of me, official papers, and I started handing him documents. And if you look at the interview, you'll see that the whole conversation changed when he started reading these official documents, particularly the Brookings Report. So that's my very, very fond memory. Many years later, one of my agents called him to try to see if they wanted to have me back on the show, because, of course, I became quite controversial with that appearance and many others. And I vividly remember that Larry said when he picked up the phone that he was on his cell because he was on Fifth Avenue going into, you know, Bergdorf Goodman's or someplace to buy something. And when the agent asked if he would like to have me back, he said, "Oh, Mr. Hoagland," he said, "I think we're going to wait on that." And that's what they did. So there are times when you can be, even for Larry King Live, a little too controversial. Anyway, Larry, you've got an extraordinary new adventure in front of you. Moving on, tonight we're going to be doing something that is a little different. We're going to try to prognosticate the future. We're going to try to, you know, use our crystal ball and kind of imagine what could be happening in the next few weeks and months based on some historical comparisons and analogs and background. My guests tonight include, of course, Dr. Richard Spence, who's a professor. Well, he was a professor. He's now a professor emeritus at the University of Idaho. You know him well. His bio is there on the guest page. We also have Georgia Lambert, who, of course, is our resident metaphysician. She has an extraordinarily interesting background. You all know it. You've been on the Times a million times. The most interesting thing is she worked for Manly Hall at the Research Institute there in L.A. for something like 10 years. So that gives her an exquisite background to talk about some things that I think will be relevant to tonight. And last but not least, Dr. Joseph Bookman is with us, my friend Joe, who earned his Ph.D. in media from the University of Indiana and was a tenured professor of marketing. He is the current chair of the Libertarian Party of Utah, the past chair of the National Liberation Platform Committee, and served as moderator of the citizen hearing and was the seventh member of that committee to ask questions of witnesses when he replaced Darlene Hooley for the events that were taking place, I think, around the disclosure events at the National Press Club for Steve Bassett and I forget the other Steve. Ah, come on. Memory. Anyway, without further ado, let me open the mics. And boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Good evening, Richard.
Glad to be back on, Richard. Yeah.
Hey, Richard.
Okay, this is difficult because I don't want to come off tonight as partisan, but there are some obvious historical events which have taken place in the last couple, 3 weeks, which really demand that we be truthful and honest and we point attention to real, easily verifiable facts. There was an insurrection at the Capitol a couple weeks ago. A whole mob stormed the Capitol, first time since 1814, and they broke in. And they were on a search and destroy mission, at least some of them, for the vice president. There were echoes over and over and over again, seen on all kinds of video. Hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. They were looking for Nancy Pelosi to do perhaps even worse things. They were looking for AOC. They were looking for, in other words, we really had a breakdown of the social order in the middle of the nation's capital by a mob, and it went on for hours and hours and hours. And as we're going to go through tonight, official response from the White House until Mike Pence literally was able to get the National Guard over to the Capitol was non-existent. Rick, has this really been the only time in 240 years compared to, let's say, 1814, when the Capitol has been subjected to this kind of mob violence?
Well, when you're talking about 1814, were you referring to the British burning of Washington?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess if you wanted to quibble there, it wasn't a mob. It was a fairly disciplined army that carried out a deliberate burning of.
You mean in 1814?
In 1814.
Yeah.
Right. Those were soldiers, reasonably well disciplined, operating in the direct commands of their superiors, who were doing that with the approval of the government in London. It was payback. One of the ways it was looked upon is that American forces, remember the British sack of Washington in 1814 came towards the end of the War of 1812, you know, which I've called the kind of America's real war of independence. But in that war, which had been going on for a while, American forces, militia forces, had burned various towns in Canada. One of them was York, which I think was the capital of Upper Canada. But they had also burned a couple of other towns recently for that. So in particular, the British naval commander, I think Admiral or Vice Admiral Coburn, was bound and determined to burn the whole place. So if he had had his way, he would have burned everything, public buildings and private buildings. The more important, the key figure there was the British Army commander, General Sir Robert Ross, and Ross went about it. Ross was rather reluctant to do it. Ross really wasn't into. He wanted basically what he would have preferred in some ways is what Alexandria, Virginia, the town right across the river.
Yes.
They were also invaded by the British, but their city fathers paid a ransom. Their idea was that, look, don't burn anything, don't trash the place, and we'll pay you a ransom to go away. The British accepted that. I don't know whether Coburn and others were in the mood to accept it in Washington, nor did the American government offer to ransom the capital. They took off to a nearby town in Maryland. But Ross actually sort of kept the destruction of buildings to very sort of deliberate burnings of the presidential mansion, the Capitol, the Treasury, and I think a variety of anything that was considered to be a public building. But most private buildings were left alone. So as sacks of cities go, it was, as these things go historically, it was pretty well behaved overall.
And highly symbolic. So messaging appears to have been alive and well even back in 1814.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead.
Richard, if you want to look at attacks on the Capitol, it's been bombed three times in the last century, and there were five.
Oh, please tell me.
Wounded in a shooting.
Joseph, please tell me.
Well, 1915, there was a bomb that went off.
Okay.
There was another bomb in 71 by the Weather Underground, which I remember when I was a kid. Another bomb in 1983. Nobody was hurt in any of the bombings. They just caused a lot of damage. I think there was a Daniel Webster painting they had to restore. I remember seeing a documentary about the restoration of that. But the biggie was the Puerto Ricans, who in 1954 got in the gallery of the House and injured five members of Congress.
Didn't they also try to assassinate Truman outside Blair House?
Yep.
It's not a unique historical event in that sense, and by some measures wasn't as bad as those three bombings. I mean, I remember at the time, there's news.
Well, when you say wasn't as bad, hang on, Joseph, when you say not as bad, five people lost their lives in this event recently.
Yeah, no bombs went off, I guess, by that measure.
But they did find two. They did find two.
The building wasn't bombed.
They did find two pipes.
It wasn't burned.
Is there a delay, guys? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. They did find two pipe bombs placed outside the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee just a few blocks from the Capitol. and they still haven't identified who put them there, and they did not go off, which was incredibly fortunate.
Okay. But those weren't in the Capitol.
They were not in the Capitol. But no. They're now looking that this appears not to have been the kind of excited, you know, reaction of a mob to, you know, events of the moment. There appeared to be some serious planning around this. So were those bombs designed to be diversions so that in case there was a big official response to protect the Capitol and the Capitol Police were totally overwhelmed? And there's all kinds of major questions about, you know, what happened to the intelligence, which intelligence got delivered to whom, who was told not to do what.
Or was there insider help?
Well, that's
was
the idea.
Was there ordering going on? Were that, members of Congress that's, showing people around in the days before?
That's exactly. Anyway, this is all going to come out in the investigation. What I want to kind of elicit from you guys is, has anything like this, in terms of magnitude, people killed and all that, since 1814, has it ever happened since? And I don't think it has.
Well, the members of the House were injured. I don't think any of them were killed, okay, in the attack for the Nationalists, who did, I think, bring automatic weapons in. You know, I don't know. When I look at the recent events, I have to tell you, I don't look at that and see over. The first impression I do not get is of a carefully planned operation being orchestrated by masterminds.
Okay.
It still looks to me like a lot of angry, ill-advised people push their way into, by some means, not entirely clear, again, in circumstances, managed to get inside the Capitol. The legislators dashed for safety, which probably was a good idea under the circumstances, and then largely milled around the place, the assorted violence aside, picking up various items and taking selfies of themselves. And...
But five people died.
What more do you have?
Five people died.
Well, yes.
And, you know,
unclear to me, Richard, that they all died directly from the violence. Certainly there was the shooting of at least one former military.
Yeah, that was one of the insurrectionists trying to break into the House chamber.
Yeah, and
the
and
other
probably,
death.
I would expect to be shot if I was doing that.
The other,
a couple of them, though, appeared to die from heart attacks.
Three appeared to die from heart attacks.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
And one was an insurrectionist. She was killed as they were trying to break through that door because, you know, half the damn Congress was behind that door. So the agent who shot obviously was trying to protect, you know, the members of the House and Senate because it was a joint session. They were all together. Anyway, the other thing is...
Well, they weren't, though. They had split up into their two chambers to debate. They had been all together. But the Senate was over in the Senate. You remember, there's this police officer who's got the...
Mr. Goodman, who led them... I watched that video, and it's eerie. It's just eerie to watch.
I debated Congressman Curtis when I ran in 2017. The fellow who won was John Curtis. He's been to my home a couple of times. We exchange emails from time to time, and he actually was responding to an email I sent him that very night about what it was like. And I said, I hope your family wasn't overly concerned, and I hope you felt safe. And it's clear that he didn't. I mean, they certainly had every reason to be frightened. I was just looking this up. The 1954 shooting, there were 30 rounds shot, five people injured who all survived. I think there was more gunfire than, I don't think there was many bullets fired this time, but certainly five deaths. By that metric, this was by far the worst. In terms of the size of the bombs that went off in the last century, there were at least three big bombings in that building. I don't know that I'd want to work there with that kind of history of that workplace.
The thing I find so intriguing, and I really just wanted to bring this up, obviously after this major event, the House, you know, the Capitol Police installed magnetometers both in the House and the Senate. And apparently a number of members do not want to go through them. And I find that really weird, not just on you know, political terms, but on in terms of just natural safety. You've just been through a crisis where your life has been basically threatened, like I presume has never been threatened before. And it's because of leaky security. So if you go to any airport, you know, you have to go through a magnetometer. It's standard operating procedure. Why are there members of the House, I'm not sure about the Senate, but why are the members of the House refusing to simply go through the magnetometers so everyone can realize that there are no weapons, no guns on the floor of the House, and again, I'm not sure about the Senate, in the wake of a really cathartic and astonishing emergency which has terrified an awful lot of members?
Well, the simple answer to that is because they don't believe that keeps guns out, and they don't. You can 3D print a gun that doesn't set off a magnetometer. You can be attacked by somebody wielding a knife. And so the generous answer to your question is they perceive the safety being increased by the good guy with a gun, and they're the good guy.
That's bizarre. You know, can you imagine a shootout against whom in the House chamber? Because, of course, nobody is going to get in there ever again without permission. Ever.
Well, you'd think that would have happened after 1915, 1954, 1971, and 1983.
Yeah, but historical memories.
And a shooting.
Yeah, but historical memories are very, 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 you know.
Well, and never make pronouncements about what will never happen again.
Yeah.
Because if you'd predicted this, you know, previously, or what can happen, you know, the one thing that the event did is that it certainly showed that it was possible.
Yeah, but it was only possible.
That it was possible.
But it was only possible because, you know, the Capitol Police did not get the right intelligence. There were political decisions made about optics. And when they finally were in the midst of the crisis, the president would not give them the National Guard. It literally went on for hours until Mike Pence was able to get the guard to show up. That, of course...
But it was possible. It happened.
But it happened under an extraordinarily... I mean, given the number of incidents that Joseph has just talked about, it's not like it happens every third day. And historical memories are very, very... What I don't understand is, given all the intelligence about restive populations, military, militias, Proud Boys, et cetera, that there was not a better defense. And I'm really looking forward to a multi-pronged investigation to find out who dropped the ball, when, and why, and was this, in fact, part of an inside job?
It sure seems that's a possibility, because the historical event that came to my mind at that time, and again here in this conversation, was Anwar Sadat, killed by his own guards, right? The people with the guns. Nobody had a gun in Egypt. I think the guys with guns were the guys that were supposed to have guns, by whatever metric you want to use, and they turned and shot him. And then I was reading those concerns for the inauguration, where they brought in all these National Guard troops. Awful lot of guys with a lot of guns, and they were re-vetting the National Guard to be sure there weren't people there who had extremist ties that might just use their gun to shoot the president.
Hmm.
I think these are concerns that some people who perceive themselves as very good guys from states with gun laws that encourage people to carry, that say, I'm serving the United States House, Congress shall make no law, and I've got a Second Amendment right. I'm carrying my gun out on the floor. That's just why I'm not defending them. I'm just saying, you asked, why would they think that? I think that's
why. Well, but why would you?
Do you trust the TSA? I mean, you look at those guys with guns at airports. Do you think all those people are mentally stable? I don't feel secure walking through the TSA. And by the way, I don't own a gun. I don't carry a gun. But I worry about those guys shooting me, too. Right, I don't think they're all perfectly stable people.
Hmm. Well, that's the whole population. Obviously,
we do not. It's getting worse.
We have a major percentage that are not stable. That's a whole other show. Rick, in the last 5 minutes here before the bottom of the hour, I want to ask you this. First of all, I'll give you a little background. I found in digging into this that according to House and Senate rules, guns, loaded guns, are not permitted on either the House or the Senate floor. Guns by themselves are permitted in the offices of the Capitol, and they're permitted in the hallways, but Joseph, you're going to love this, they only can be carried around empty. No live ammo.
To be precise, they are permitted on the floor of the House. They're just not permitted to be in the hands of anybody other than the people that you call the police.
I think that's a technicality.
Yeah, it is. The distinction is whether you're employed as a police officer or you're employed as a member of the United States Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And one group can carry guns and the other group can't. But it's not like they're not permitted. They're permitted, but only in that one group of human beings, not the other. And certainly not the visitors.
Well, look at what happened back in the 19... When was the Puerto Rican attack against Truman?
The Puerto Rican attack on the United States House was 54.
54.
54.
Okay. Okay. Big question. We got about a minute. Maybe we'll pick this up on the other side. If the mob had been successful, if they'd been able to assassinate various members during the joint session counting of the ballots from the Electoral College, what would have happened? Because I hear people saying casually, oh, it would have meant that Trump would still remain president. And I can't imagine that that's within the House or Senate rules and or within the Constitution, that just because you have an insurrection and a mob and death, that it interrupts the legal process of the transition from one administration to another. Or does it?
Well, as far as I know, there's nothing in the Constitution that would cover that possibility.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say as well. And I think you wouldn't survive that trying to stay president through that kind of crazy.
Well, you'd have to do something very cute and clever. And so what we're going to do, and why did I lose my... oh, that's weird. I lost... Did I lose all my stuff? Ah, that's really bizarre. I seem to have lost everything I had stored in memory.
By the way, it was 1950 that Truman was subjected to a potential assassin, also by Puerto Rican independence.
Right.
So 50 and then 54 was the attack on the House.
Wow.
It's not a particularly safe place to work.
Well, particularly at certain times of the year, I imagine. Anyway, I'm having a small computer problem here, so talk among yourselves while I try to solve it, okay? I saved a whole bunch of very careful things, and they've all disappeared. I don't understand. I will not point fingers at anyone. We're going to take a short break here, and then I will be back with the resumption of what we're talking about. I'm trying to chew gum and walk at the same time, which also is very difficult. So let us do this, and oh, this is terrible. I do not like having these things happen on live radio. It's very, very disturbing. So, tell you what, we're going to take a break. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
article I wrote a couple of weeks ago that says, am I being selfish? And I said, absolutely, but I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for my grandchildren and my grandchildren's children. I see the loss of rights and freedoms. I've lived long enough to know what's happened here, and I cannot stand back and simply comply. I'm going to resist those measures with everything that I have, emotionally, psychologically, physically, legally. I cannot allow our rights and freedoms to be taken from us. We have to stand up for them. This is where I say that we have to become adults. We have to stand up for our rights and freedoms. We can't ask for them. We have to demand that they be honored and respected. To me, the masking is part of the strategy of totalitarian tiptoe. We just keep encroaching on you, and it's just a little bit worse than it was yesterday. And most people don't see it, but we see it. And that's why this program and the work that you guys are doing is so important.
Hi, this is Ted Kuntz from Vaccine Choice Canada. I just want to reach out and express my gratitude to Other Side of the News for all that you guys are doing to empower humanity and bring us to a higher state of consciousness. The time that we shared together was a real pleasure, rich conversation, and I know that all of you are higher conscious beings who are part of the solution. I just want to express my gratitude to Cynthia, Timothy, and Annetta, and your program, The Other Side of the News. You guys are great.
And welcome back, everyone, for this Saturday night, January 23rd, 2021. Things progress. So back to our guests, Dr. Joseph Bookman, Dr. Rick Spence, and Georgia Lambert. Where were we? Oh, we were talking about what would have happened if that mob had successfully killed several key senators, congressmen, whatever, on the literal moment when the votes from the Electoral College were being counted. What would have happened, and who would have made the decision?
Well, apparently they headed straight for the parliamentarian's office, and that took some knowledge of the Capitol beyond what you get on a typical tour, because they were under the impression that the parliamentarian's office still had the boxes with the Electoral College votes in it. But they were scurried away. So what if they had burned all the Electoral College ballots? Would a President Trump have been able to successfully declare martial law and extend his term in office?
That's what I'm asking. That's what I'm asking, yes.
I think there would have been a crowd burning the White House down. I might have gone up there and been a part of it. I don't think the American people would tolerate it. Something else would have happened. I'm not sure exactly what.
Well, wait, when you say the American people wouldn't have tolerated it, this last election was almost like 50-50. And we know that 77% of Republicans now think, still think, I've been brought to the realm of thinking that Biden is an illegal, illegitimate president because the election was stolen.
Yeah, but you don't get to correct it with that level of violence.
That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in that cultural meme, when there's all kinds of social media pushing that point of view, if the president had in fact declared martial law and aggressed—
I think he would have lost his core supporters in that moment. I don't think a lot of them would have hung in there after that level of violence. A level of violence that involves kidnapping senators.
Yeah, but they already think that he was cheated out of the election.
Yeah, but I don't think they would say that that's the way to correct it. I think he would have lost, and he did. January 6th, he lost a lot of that momentum among those crazy, if you want to say those crazy people, and certainly there's a lot of voter fraud. There's voter fraud in every election.
Yeah, but is it significant?
But not enough shift. Yeah, not
See,
enough
that's,
to shift.
That's the key thing. It's not that you don't have one speck of dust on your carpet. It's how many specks of dust before the carpet needs to be cleaned. Elections.
I agree.
Go ahead.
I just don't think that declaring martial law would be survivable, even if half the country believed he had been cheated. Again, it's close to just barely half.
But you just said it.
I think once you declare martial law, you lose a lot of your core support, and the other side's going to win. That's what I think. I don't know that to be true.
Well, again, let's kind of try to test this. Rick, given that the Constitution is blatantly silent on all of this, and the House rules and the two chambers together, all of that, in the vacuum that would have been created, if Trump had literally declared martial law under the Sedition Act, remember, there's a legal framework to do this, what happens to that constitutional at noon on the 20th, the government changes hands?
Well, let's go back a ways. Let's suppose that the people in the Capitol had gotten a hold of the Electoral College ballots and they'd all put them in a pile and they'd burned them, that they'd physically destroyed them.
Right.
That changes nothing. Okay. What is that? Let's put it this way. In your mind, or in the mind of any reasonable person, does it mean that simply because the physical ballots of the Electoral College were destroyed, that the college never voted? It's not like they can't vote again. It's not like those votes aren't recorded somewhere else. That was, at the most, to me, if you were really if somebody was really trying to get their hands on the votes and destroy them, and they thought that that was going to change the course of American political history, they were just nuts.
Well, that's what they thought. That's exactly what they thought.
At the most, that was an act of desperation. That would have been a pure act of desperation because it wouldn't have changed anything.
Well,
Hang on.
If they had succeeded in literally killing key members of the House and Senate, who would have been left to vote? Where would you have been left to vote? When would they have voted? And remember, it's only, 3 weeks until the transition formally takes place according to the Constitution. I'm just wondering, in this exigency... Go ahead.
I think we have an example of what would have happened that just came out in the news recently. Donald Trump, Barr resigned. He had Jeff Rosen in there. Trump tried to replace Rosen with Jeff Clark.
Yes.
And Jeff Clark said, "Hey, I'll support you. We'll stop this, and we'll have some sort of recount." And Trump was threatened with mass resignations of everybody over justice. So let's say Trump says, "Sedition Act, things are crazy, I'm president until we figure it out." He'll be governing alone. A big chunk of his administration would have walked out and resigned.
I am not sure of that at all.
Well,
because people have been...
I'm not sure of it either, but you had threats of mass resignations just when he was talking
about... But that was
about
because of a blatant inside political act. This is a case where on live television, you've got a mob burning the... Who knows where they would have gone. People killed, let's assume the worst case scenario. Under that condition, if Trump had stepped in and you know, activated the Insurrection Act and declared martial law, how many Americans would have said, thank God, order is being restored, and then just let them, quote, sort it out? How would it have been sorted out, again, under the Constitution, Rick?
Well, there's no means to sort that out under the Constitution. I mean, the Constitution isn't... What would have happened is that if they had managed to wipe out Congress entirely, put them all up against a wall and shoot them, then there would have been no one to vote. That would have kind of complicated things. But if you just killed certain people, then the rest of them would vote as they were supposed to do as well. And you know, if someone is killed in a car accident on the way to a vote on the seat of Congress, that doesn't stop things from going ahead. Those who would survive would constitute as long. I don't know, you could get the lawyers in later to say whether or not they had a quorum, but as long, I would say, as there were a sufficient number to have a quorum to vote, they would have done so, with or without anybody who was killed.
A lot of states...
The whole thing is, the action didn't do anything, okay?
Right.
At the most, that would have been a symbolic action. You wouldn't buy it, I wouldn't buy it. Let's put it this way. If Donald Trump had any real... I'll go in this way, had any real gumption as a would-be dictator, if that was his plan, I'm not saying it was, he, at the moment his supposed followers took control of the Capitol, he would, as a commander-in-chief, walked in, took control of them, ordered to do whatever he wanted. Still, as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, he could have ordered them to protect him. He could have just gone, you know, I mean, you're well beyond the envelope of anything possible at that point, but, you know, politics is nothing but the art of the possible.
Right.
And I also go back to the history is not made by majorities or what majorities think or what majorities do, because majorities generally do nothing. Okay? Most people just sit around and watch. It's made by active minorities. So is it possible, not necessarily Donald Trump, but could you have someone who is a more Caesarian mindset?
Someone who was better at it?
Yeah.
Someone who was better at it, someone who was more determined, more ruthless. You've got to be able to do that. Could they have potentially have done it and gotten away with it? Well, I don't know. Maybe. But the other thing we got to keep in mind here is a lot of what we've been talking about are things that didn't happen.
Well, but we came so incredibly... But we came incredibly close to them.
We don't know. We don't know how close we came. Okay.
We didn't come close. Yeah. If this was a coup, it was the most impotent, wimpy coup in the history of coups. And if they killed all 536 members, counting the vice president of Congress, then I don't know all of my state laws, but in a lot of states, governors can appoint temporary members of Congress pending a special election. So you could still have enough people appointed by governors almost instantly to say,
but guys, you're missing the obvious point. Once the president declares martial law under that act, under the Insurrection Act, what happens to the idea of Congress? Because no longer is Congress in control. It's the executive.
I think it depends on the president. If President Trump did that, I think he would be alone without a lot of... Here's how you get an effective coup. You have to have the military on your side.
Yes.
Member of the Joint Chiefs saying, we're going to follow the Constitution, not the guy in the White House. And everybody said, hell yeah, we are. So,
except we now know that during those several hours, I don't know if it was four or six or whatever, when you know, the Capitol is desperately calling the White House and saying, we need the National Guard, and Trump's doing nothing, they tried the Pentagon, and the Pentagon set up a committee, and it turns out that the brother of Mike Flynn, remember Mike Flynn? Charles Flynn was part of the decision-making crowd that refused to allow the National Guard to go to the Capitol during the riot.
We're talking about whether it would last for more than a few hours, and it wouldn't have lasted for more than a few hours.
That's the point.
Joseph is entirely right. The active minority that had the control in the situation, had there been an attempt at a presidential coup, which is what we would be talking about here, it all comes down as to whether or not a sufficient portion of the military would obey the president or not.
Yeah, and in the midst
they're
of
the only ones who would count in that situation.
And in the midst of a national crisis, why would they have not? He's the duly authorized commander in chief.
But they don't take an oath to him.
Right.
They take an oath to the Constitution.
Against all enemies domestic.
Exactly. You're looking at a whole domestic revolution, and you're not going to do anything if he asked you to? Of course they would have. And then it would have been one of those things where, you know, it's like turning up the water on the hot water on the frog, the standard cliche. You do it incrementally. And it's before you know it, you know, is it irretrievable? What happens to the Constitution when the Insurrection Act is formally declared?
Depends on the nature of the insurrection.
Okay.
And maybe I just think the idea that a President Trump defeated an election, which has been discussed, investigated, taken to court, whatever, over the period of weeks, is somehow going to say, hey, Insurrection Act, I'm staying in office, and the United States military is going to back that up, I hope is a very, very low probable scenario, like impossible.
Given the polls, I don't think I think you're being much too sanguine. I think we really dodged an incredible bullet by the grace of, you know, Mr. Goodman, if not a few others. I mean, something like 50 of the Capitol Police were injured, and one was killed, Mr. Sicknick, and the other Capitol policeman, apparently, because of what happened, he went home and he killed himself. Why? Did he take secrets with him, or was he murdered to keep secrets with him?
Well, I'd say that if there was a moment for a coup, if there was one, then it passed. All right. Again, it didn't happen. Trump didn't declare martial law. Order was restored. The military did not intervene. You know, all kinds of things could have happened, but they didn't.
Rick, let me ask you this, if you don't mind.
No, by all means.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In the aftermath of what did happen.
Yeah.
And whatever investigations had come from it, how much did that enhance the argument that D.C. now needs to be a state so that you could have a governor who could order the National Guard out rapidly? How much of this was caused because of the unique characteristic of D.C. not being a state? There's no governor that can order the National Guard in easily.
Because they have no National Guard. Remember, all the Guard people we've seen now there, 25,000, give or take, they're from all these other states. The governor of Maryland tried to send troops after he got desperate calls from the Capitol, and he couldn't get permission from the Pentagon to do it.
I'm just asking if this is going to enhance the argument for D.C. to be granted statehood.
It won't hurt the argument, you know, but D.C. has a mayor, it has a police force. I don't think you'd necessarily have to have a governor and a National Guard to be called in. I mean, there's an awful lot of... I mean, the one thing to me when I look at this is that I think it just caught the established order flat-footed. I mean, they just, you know... I'm not sure that the insurrectionists, whatever you want to call them, rioters, protesters, rebel, whatever term, the...
See, I'm sorry, Rick.
The intruders.
Let me interrupt. I don't buy that argument because for weeks there had been all kinds of excitation to come to this rally on the 6th. Yeah. The president himself had tweeted... it's going to be wild, 15 exclamation points, et cetera, et cetera. So he was inviting his people to this rally just down the street. And then during the event, he says, pointing down Pennsylvania Avenue, go that away. I'm with you.
Yeah, but he wasn't.
Yeah, and he didn't go with them.
Well,
and
according to reports,
was watching it on TV, he was expressing dismay that the people shown on TV were low-class people and couldn't possibly be his supporters. And you look at the images, the people who got into the chambers of the House and Senate, They weren't exactly dressed like who you would imagine would be a Trump supporter.
You mean Mr. Buffalo Horns?
I think he might have been embarrassed by it. There were certainly some reports that he expressed dismay that these people couldn't be his supporters because they looked low class. I think he was, I think he's borderline insane. But
well,
I think
would they have gotten into Mar-a-Lago? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, right. No.
Okay.
No. That's a great...
No, they would never have gotten into Mar-a-Lago, therefore they couldn't possibly.
All right, let us do our historical comparison, because you remember what I called you back and asked you to kind of brief people in the 21st century who have no sense of history because they're not taught history? Talk about Kristallnacht, because I think this may have been the kind of screwy model for what did not happen.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I would agree with that. What was Kristallnacht? The Night of Broken Glass. So that takes us to Germany in November 1938. And it's basically where the Nazi regime, having legally and economically harassed Jews in Germany for some time, where things turned violent. That was precipitated, though. I mean, you know, there's a whole sort of backstory. What happened is...
That's why we have 3 hours.
Where shall we begin? We will not go back to protoplasmic slime. Let's go back to January 1933. Well, you could.
Yeah, you
when
could.
When Hitler is made Chancellor of Germany. Made Chancellor, I might say, in an entirely constitutional manner. So this is something to keep in mind. Hitler does not seize power. Right?
Right.
He took power legally. He then expanded upon that.
Yeah, but hang on. I know where you're right. going, and let me loop around.
All right.
If Trump had declared martial law and activated the Insurrection Act, he would have legally taken that power.
Well, here's the real comparison. I think if you want to find a comparison in 1930s Germany that in any way sort of echoes what happened in Washington recently, it was shortly after Hitler became chancellor. That, again, was highly controversial. Germany was a very polarized state. You know, only about a third of the electorate had voted for the Nazis. That meant the two-thirds were essentially supportive of other parties, including the communists. And then what happened was that the German capital, the Reichstag, caught fire.
Yeah, but how?
That took place in February. Well, it was arson.
Oh, okay.
Now, the question, so it was...
Well,
it was
when you said caught fire, I was looking for the other shoe.
Well, yes, okay, it was arson. So the general assumption today is that it was the Nazis who said it. I mean, they certainly arranged it, because we'll see what happens. But that's one of those things that if you look at all the evidence, that it certainly was the Nazis who burned the Reichstag, which they had no particular respect for. What they managed to do, however, was they managed to blame it on this kind of mentally limited guy named Marinus van der Lubbe, who was from Holland, but who also had been affiliated with the Communist Party. And they said, aha, you see what has happened? The sacred Reichstag of the German people, a symbol of our government, has been set ablaze by this communist, and therefore there is a communist threat. This was all going to be the signal for a coup. And, of course, the Reichstag then reconvenes elsewhere, and Hitler pushes through one of the things that they hand him on a silver platter are the Enabling Acts. And what the Enabling Acts did is that they essentially suspended elements of the Constitution and allowed for a certain period of time Hitler to have quasi-dictatorial powers. They suspended general jurisprudence, allowed arrests and investigations to take place. This was all a reaction to the shocking attack on what? The Capitol. All right. So, in other words, what the Nazis did was to burned down the Reichstag, managed to effectively blame it on the other side as that their enemies who were doing it, and from that way then leverage for Hitler and the new government extended powers. And those powers never went away. The Enabling Acts were temporary. They became permanent. And over the next several months, the Nazis consolidated power. It was something, again, which took place slowly. That's the kind of... crisis.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I see. For those who aren't familiar with Nazi Germany history, and by the way, you're doing a beautiful job. This is the plot of The Phantom Menace. George Lucas stole this. You got an evil emperor who pretends to have an attack that he had happened to play the victim to create the other army, and is controlling both armies to create a civil war while gaining ever-increasing power. And you got Princess Amidala, whatever, saying, so this is how liberty dies, not with sadness, but with thunderous applause. That didn't happen here. I think you could also, though, draw a bigger arc of history, and Rick, you're the historian, but as a libertarian, it sure looks to me like we're slowly doing that. That Congress is abandoning its authority and powers, and creating an ever increasing concentration of authority over there in the office of the presidency, such that we can get on day one of a presidency, or day one and two, something like 40 executive orders that. Historically, at least, would have required some time to be debated and then passed in Congress.
Wait. Executive orders do not require any debate. They're at the, deliberation of the president.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that. The Congress, we're seeing a slower... What happened in Germany, I think we're seeing happen in America, but over a period of 50 years, not over a period of 5 days. That slowly the executive gets more and more authority, more and more power.
It effectively allows the president to legislate.
Yeah, which should not
be. But don't executive orders, Rick and Joe, have to be under the umbrella of previously passed congressional legislation, which needs detail like regulations? The agencies go through and they write all kinds of regulations under the Enabling Act, that kind of thing. So, a president can't just create law. It has to be traceable back to some law already passed by Congress.
And Congress, and they're only, I think, good for 60 days unless Congress can repeal it. It can step in and it can suspend them. But they never do that, all right?
Oh, I've never heard of that. Exactly. Remember Rex 84?
They never do. They're supposed to have oversight over these things, and they do not exercise their oversight.
So they have abrogated their constitutional responsibility.
Right.
Hell yes, they have.
But why?
Right.
Why would the separate, independent, co-equal branch, and we're talking now decades, not just under Trump, why would they have systematically, since World War II, if not before, acceded more and more power to the president?
That's a really good question.
That's why I asked
it. It becomes about loyalty to a party, and to the president is the presumed leader of that party as your political leader. Also, that the thing about executive orders is that because they tend to go into effect immediately, is that they're a great way to push things through that you can't get through Congress. I mean, if you look, I'd say
Hey, Rick, we're coming up to a hard break, top of the hour. So let's hold it there. My guests this morning are Georgia Lambert, who's been very silent because she's waiting for exactly the right time, and it's coming up in the next half hour. She's also, am I doing something weird here? I think I'm doing something really weird. I'm having problems with my sound tonight. That's definitely not what I want to have happening. So here we are. Okay, we're on track. You're on the other side of midnight. My guests include Dr. Joseph Bookman, Dr. Rick Spence, as I said, Georgia Lambert. And we're talking about the past as a springboard to the future. When we come back, we'll look ahead. You are on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out.